everybody, and welcome to another episode of Two-Headed Game Master. I'm Cosmo, the first head.
And I'm Dane, the freedom head.
I forgot what episode we're doing. Two-Headed Game Master is a podcast about writing, designing, running, and playing role-playing games, where we discuss our favorite hobbies, share our thoughts with you, and even play some games sometimes. I was trying to figure out your joke.
My joke?
Yeah. And I thought we were doing a different episode right now, because we were working on another episode this evening. But,
that we were.
What are we talking about today, Freedom Head?
Well, we're here talking about video games, tabletop role-playing games, and their influence on each other.
Ooh.
Specifically, Helldivers 2, What Can Freedom Do For You? That's not the tagline, but it should be.
It's also not the only video game.
Truth, that we will be talking about.
But, what do Helldivers 2 and Dungeons & Dragons have in common with each other? Well, more than you may think. It's not just hiding as characters, pretending as dipshits in sci-fi or fantasy.
That's a joke for our role-playing group.
Yeah.
Because that's a thing now.
Hiding and pretending as.
Great setup for a joke.
So, go through this. What do we...
Okay, so yes, signposting, right? A converging Venn diagram, right? We all know what the Venn diagram is. It's the two circles that touch each other.
Gross. Or sexy. Maybe it's hot. I don't know. Maybe they're into it.
Also, there's other types of touching. Anyways.
No, there isn't.
Then we'll go through what tabletop role-playing games have taken, or what we think they've taken from video games. And then we hit the other side, what we think video games have taken from tabletop role-playing games. And then we're just going to talk about, like, growing pains and the future.
What we think the future of this might look like as it continues down this path. So, the converging Venn diagrams of the two types of gaming. One, so we use the term converging. You know what a Venn diagram is. We're saying they're converging, like they're getting closer and closer together.
They're touching more.
And that's basically the thesis of this episode. The idea that we want to talk about is we think as the years go on, that's all wrong. they appear to be getting more and more like each other, trying to take the best parts of each and integrate them into themselves. So, taking lessons from each other.
Right. They usually take the positive aspects of each other, right? You've heard of a role-playing video game.
Yeah.
Ooh, I wonder where they got that terminology from.
And I would say, okay, so usually taking on the most positive aspects. I don't think anyone ever tries to take on, like, hey, this is worse in a video game. we should do it this way in our pen and paper game, obviously. Like, everyone's trying to take, something good from the other form of media and integrate it into your video game or your pen and paper game. But it's not always successful. We're going to talk about that more. But it's cool right now to see how much experimentation is going on. And, you know, how the cool things from both sides are starting to appear in the other one.
So, well, I mean, you know, if you're not getting it yet, you know, check out this weird loop that I just thought of.
Oh.
We didn't do a lot of research or whatever.
I mean, we play games.
But, like, you go back to the, like, 1990, early 2000s, like, role-playing games, like, their stats are just insane. Like, they might throw a stat in there for everything. Like, for example, Morrowind. Holy shit, did that have a lot of specific things of, like, you know, weapons have their own attacks. And, like, here's your slashing damage and your piercing damage. And, like, this is how you do the slash. This is how you do a pierce and whatever. Fast forward, so early 2000s RPG... Right, they're taking a lot of lessons from tabletop role-playing games about, like, you know, stats.
Yeah.
Right? Fast forward to Skyrim.
When Bethesda got their mitts on the Fallout series and, like, implemented the special system, which is from the GURPS pen and paper role-playing game, from what I understand. I don't know if it spelled special in that, but like, you know, they were like, this is a set of stats from a pen and paper game, essentially, and we're gonna attach stuff to that.
They did that in the early Fallout games. Like, the stats just go crazy. Like, there's so many freaking different, like, you know, stats that mean specific things. Fast forward to Skyrim and Fallout 4, and it's like, you know what? We don't actually need a different stat for this attack versus this attack. Like, if, you know, in Skyrim, it's like you have melee.
Yeah.
All right? Is it two-handed or one-handed?
Yeah.
And that's all we're doing.
Like, they break it down a little bit, but they don't break it down.
Is it an axe? Is it a spear? Is it a sword?
Two-handed piercing stat versus your, you know, one-handed slashing.
Right? And in Fallout 4, like, they went away with those all together, and it's all about perks and, you know, your base attributes, right?
Right.
Which is also something we kind of did with Afterlife, but...
we did a little bit. There's a lot of... I would say there's a lot of criticism you can level at Fallout 4 about its quality as a role-playing experience. Mm-hmm. But I actually... I like that trend towards, you know, simplifying the... simplifying how you manage your character that way.
Which is exactly the last part of the loop, right? So, like, say it started tabletop role-playing games. They taught early role-playing video games... You need a bunch of stats. Mm-hmm. Video role-playing game said, you know what? That's actually ass.
Yeah.
Fuck that.
I mean, it took them 20 years, but...
And now tabletop role-playing games have also...
They've started to simplify and reduce. And we found ourselves doing that with, like, the most recent iteration of a new system that we're playing. You know, we were looking a lot at Cyborg and Morkborg. And like, four stats. That's all you need. And... You still play the same. You just do less math and look less stuff up. And it seems like it's working pretty well. That loop. So it's a cool way to...
They inform each other, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk specifically what tabletop role-playing games have learned from the video games.
Okay. So this first one is interesting. It's not really... it's not really any sort of gameplay or game design, but virtual tabletops. Oh, sorry, remote play. Then we'll get into VTTs. So remote play, this is just like advancement in technology. We talked about this idea, this concept a little bit ago when we talked about Sicko Zone most recently. The idea that you couldn't really do Sicko Zone the way we were talking about it back in like the 80s. Mm-hmm. Like you could...
It would be damn fucking hard,
you
know, though.
Or like early 90s. You could do it over a fucking email thread, but like what a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the remote technology that we all carry around in our pockets and that we like use for work and, you know, everyone has in their homes, it allows you to play remote, which, you know, previously was pretty, you know... That was a
unique to video games.
Yeah, that was right? A cool selling point of video games. You can play Halo over the internet with your friends, or like World of Warcraft, probably a better example for role playing.
Or like, you could play chess, right? Like you could play that sitting on the coffee table together, or you could play it over the internet.
Yeah.
How about that one?
You just play a bunch more chess with a bunch more people, expanding communities, connecting, you know, over distances. Now you're connecting over the thing that you both love, and it doesn't matter that you never would have met each other in real life.
And it took tabletop role-playing games a little bit to catch up to that, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I feel like that was also a way to control the money.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it definitely seems like with last year, Wizards of the Coast, big fucking. Their licensing fuck up and the way they wanted to turn, you know, D&D Beyond into paid subscription. Just, yeah. It does seem like, you know, if the money people have their way with it, it's not going to be a tool for community and exciting gameplay. It's going to be a fucking leech, but...
Because when we wrote this, I didn't even consider this that aspect of it, of why did it take, you know, until 2020, and that's a loose term, is, you know, the 2010s, sure. Why did it take, like, D&D Beyond to actually become good?
To become a thing.
And, well, like,
from what I understand, and I can speak to this barely at all, I just know that it existed, is that 4th edition D&D had a dedicated first-party virtual tabletop designed to let people play remotely that way, but I have no idea if it was good, and I don't know who used it, because we weren't in the scene back then, and I've never touched that edition. And I also, back then, I wasn't young enough to be online enough to engage with that. I was too young to be online enough to do that.
Well said.
Anyway. So I talked about VTTs on accident a couple times in that. Let's actually talk.
What is a VTT?
What is a VTT? It's a it's
virtual.
It's when you turn your television backwards and it faces the wall.
What does TT VTT stand for? Cot. Yeah. I don't know either.
Yeah.
All right.
So virtual tabletops.
Oh, well, okay.
I'm got done the joking. The joke is dead. We're moving past it. It wasn't that good. Virtual tabletops software that takes the place of, you know, the table that you used to, that you gather around, and you have your paper and you have your physical dice. Play virtually on a, you know, piece of software that mimics the tabletop. And so, like, Roll20, big famous one, Owlbear Rodeo, I've messed around with. You throw a map up on the screen. You drag tokens around to represent characters. You can put terrain on it, whatever. And the more robust packages, they also support, integrated character sheets, mm-hmm. dice rolling.
So like your automatic tracking and calculations, right?
And I ask you for a, give me a dex save.
So I click the little dex save stat, and it rolls a dice for me.
It does the buttons, the button does the math for you. Rolls a graphic of a dice on the screen, tells you the result after it adds it all up in the computer. That's the way video games do it. Lancer, which I think is really cool, but I've never played. I've just watched videos about it. Dope-looking mech pilot RPG. I don't know if it's a first-party or a fan-made thing, but basically it has a dedicated... The entire game exists in a website where you can build your mechs, create your characters, and then, you know, put them on a battlefield. And you are meant to play it that way because it's designed to do all the fiddly, you know, number crunching, keeping track of stuff. It's designed to do that in the computer so that you are just saying, this is what my character does. Okay, click on your guy, move him over here. Now give me the roll for it.
Right, you know, it's a streamlined system,
mm-hmm.
right? And also a streamlined rule set. Like, you know, nowadays everybody knows, like, dexterity. Mm-hmm. It might be slightly different game to game.
You might call it agility.
Right, but, like, you know, mm-hmm. or you could guess at least, right?
And if you've played more than one RPG, you start to learn that language, and you're like,
mm-hmm.
yeah, you know what they mean. We call it mind in most of our games, but you know that's intelligence.
Yeah.
Right?
Which is something very, I wouldn't say only in video games did this happen, but it is the standardization of, like, control schemes, right?
Yeah.
First-person shooters. Everybody knows the trigger shoots the gun.
Yeah.
Pull the trigger, you shoot the gun.
Yeah.
The right trigger. Not the left trigger. Not the A button. And, like, of course, you can mess with a control scheme, but you'd be insane.
Yeah. Where are we in here?
Sorry. Streamlined mechanics.
Streamlined rule sets, rules presented in standard format. Yeah, FPS control scheme. Sorry. I got lost on our stupid
piece of paper. It's a thick-ass outline.
And that was the thing, like, that used to irritate. I never played Bioshock because it had a stupid fucking control scheme on the Xbox 360. And that irritated me so much that it was so, like, just be the same.
Mm.
Just be the same as every other video game. I want to use the controller intuitively so that there is, like, if the controller is any sort of speed bump between my brain and what goes on screen,
mm-hmm.
fucking irritates me. Pen and paper games are starting to, you know, starting to pick up on that. They want to reduce as much of that as possible mm-hmm. and reduce the...
The looking for
yeah.
the numbers, right? So you got a thick-ass character sheet and, like, the DM or GM, excuse me, if you're not, mm-hmm. you know, playing that one game, is, like, give me a pickpocket roll.
Yeah.
And so then, like, you know, you, like, get your sheet out. Okay, wait a second. So pickpocket is it a skill? Should I be looking in the skills?
And you're like, yeah, it's a skill under this attribute. Thing.
Oh, but it's nighttime, so hold on.
Yeah.
You know, all that shit. Where it's just like, okay, give me a dex roll at advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I can do that. Yeah. You know, that's one thing I gotta find. Boom.
And that's the way a lot of our designing has been going, but we've noticed that trend in other... number one, a standardization of languages. Once you have a large enough player base that basically understands, you know, oh, you call it might, you call it strength, whatever, it's the same thing. You use that stat for this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to reduce and streamline the complexity of the rule set to, you know, not get in the way. And that's not universal. A lot of pen and paper games are still... crunchy and embrace that crunchiness. They're like, that's part of the fun, but
yeah. And then we can get into this more in the growing pains section, right? You know, the fucking diehard, you know, sweat lords are like, oh well, it, like, takes the specialization out of the game.
Yeah,
it's like, yeah, but like,
but how much specialization really, how much does hyper robust specialization actually impact gameplay?
Right.
I would say, I was just going to go out, I'm going to say it. I would say not as much as it slows things down and interferes exactly. with actually yeah. playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So.
Anyways, we'll talk about more about that later. Let's talk about more some good things. Right? So, like, what we were all just talking about, right? Streamline and all that stuff.
Yeah, streamlining rule sets and virtual tabletop tools that...
Yeah. VTT.
Tools that do the calculations and integrate the mechanics for you so that all you have to do is, like, press a button or look at one answer. All of this is designed to reduce the load on the human CPU, the dungeon master, game master, who actually has to...
calculate, yeah. you know, a result.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the less math involved, the less things that they have to keep in their mind...
Mm-hmm.
The faster the processing goes, you know?
Right. And, you know, I would say desirable. You want to spend less time doing that and more time playing the game, both as a player and a game master. So, yeah, reducing the load on your brain computer to actually, you know, run the simulation, that's good. And in a video game, you know, the video game does it for you. With the graphics and doing all the calculations in behind the screen, making TTRPGs trying to be more like that.
Mm-hmm. Right? Because, and like, obviously, we don't mean looking up anything, right? When you first start playing a new system, you're going to be like, okay, wait a second. How
you got to learn.
How
you
do these common things go, right? But like, you won't have to look up three things for every role, right? Because it should be blanket rules where you're just like, okay, I know the base rule, so I can apply it to this unique situation.
Yeah.
Right? I don't have to look up a thing. I just use my game master judgment. Right? Hard to do when there's a shitload of complicated rules and, like, your players are like, well, this actually is this or whatever. Anyways.
Yeah.
The point is, video games have taught tabletop role-playing games to streamline some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's another thing that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I personally have not engaged with this.
I've not either, but watched some videos and read some stuff.
There are a lot more products out there now for solo play. Like, you want to play a tabletop role-playing game, but, like, you know, it's too hard to schedule shit, or, like, you know, this one is just for me, right? You can play those by yourself now. They have solo tabletop role-playing games.
Yeah. And they come in all types. And they're not just like a board game or like a card game that you play with yourself. Mm. They are designed to give you the same engagement and like imaginative feedback as a pen and paper RPG. You play them by yourself with some mechanic of like random generation to mimic a game master or a computer. And you play by yourself. So one cool one that I heard about a couple years ago is called Thousand Year Vampire.
Vampire.
Hemomancer. Hemomancer. It's a journaling game, basically. You're just journaling. It's a creative writing exercise, but it's prompts dictated by dice rolls on various tables. And it's about, you know, writing the story of your vampire as if, you know, he was keeping a journal over his centuries-long life before he, like, you know, goes insane or gets killed by the villagers or whatever happens. And it's a creative journaling prompt, basically, but with enough gameplay elements that, you know, it's a solo pen and paper role-playing game, because you roll dice, you create a character, and then, you know, instead of talking to another player or party, you write.
Yeah.
And then I've seen some other ones that have various like grid-based combat systems, kind of like board games like Gloomhaven, where enemies have stats and or positioning, like cards, and positioning and, stuff,
you know,
and
attack.
And so you have to like manage your resources. It's not really about not knowing what the enemy is going to do. The enemy is going to do fairly predictable things, maybe a little bit unpredictable with the randomness of dice rolls, but they're going to try and fight you, and you got to fight them, and then you progress through a campaign by yourself without a dungeon master, without a party.
Yeah. And just a little disclaimer here. These products could have existed in the 80s, but we weren't fucking alive.
Yeah.
And they never made it to the mainstream. So,
yeah.
Get bent.
And I'm sorry if that's the case, but, like, you know, if I'd seen such a thing on the shelf of like Target,
Borders, you know, or whatever,
a bookstore or a toy store when I was a kid, I might have picked it up and tried to get into it. It would have appealed to me if I knew what it was.
But I think this is also the perfect case that video games taught us to look for that stuff.
That's true. This is a thing coming from video games, because this is how you primarily engage with video games, aside from, you know, like competitive multiplayer stuff, which is not really what we're talking about as far as what
lessons.
Yeah,
whatever.
Lessons from video games here. So I think pretty fucking cool. I haven't gotten around to doing one of them yet, and I might not ever, just because of time, but
it's there.
I think the
if
idea
you ever
is
want
cool
to, it's there.
They definitely exist, and yeah, so solo play TTRPGs, but playing solo as if it was a video game.
Now,
all right,
let's get into what video games have learned
from TTRPGs. Okay.
You want to kick it off?
Yeah, I'll kick it off. Okay, so this it might be a bit of a stretch to say that like this only that they got this from TTRPGs. It might have just been a good idea. Mm-hmm. But the focus on impactful player choice and branching narratives, specifically in like CRPGs from like the 90s, but also including, you know, good role playing games like some of the Fallout games or like the Mass Effect trilogy, stuff like that. Knights of the Old Republic.
Mm-hmm. Like, that game is one of the, it's like the beginning of that video or that loop that I talked about, right? Like Knights of the Old Republic had so much shit going on in it. It was still super cool and awesome, but like I can never go back to that fucker. Like I've tried in the last 10 years. I was like, oh, Knights of the Old Republic was dope.
There's meant to be some quite good remake on its way, but it's in some development hell. I don't know who's in charge of it right now, where the money is. It's probably money.
It's probably the monies. But, like, you know, the same way I could... I tried to go back to Morrowind, like, 4 weeks ago. Literally 4 weeks ago. I started it up. I got to, like, the... Oh, tell me about yourself and we'll make stats for you. Saw the stat sheet and was like...
Oh, fuck.
Never mind. Nah. I'll do Fallout New Vegas instead.
New Vegas. The best one.
And then, you know, Fallout, the show dropped, and I'm like, obviously I made the right choice.
You were already doing another
Fallout? Well, I had already, like, started and, like, had an idea and, like, never got around to actually playing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But thinking about it, like, yeah, I'm going to do my new Fallout.
I made sure Fallout New Vegas still worked on the Xbox, and I was like, okay.
Nice, installed, ready to play.
When I get mad at Elden Ring, I'm going to pop into New Vegas.
Mm.
Anyways, enough about my life.
Yeah.
So,
okay, so, great examples. Knights of the Old Republic, Mass Effect, the old Fallout 1 and 2, the isometric Fallouts. 3, sorta, not really. New Vegas for sure. Then I would say, I mean, you know, wrote this bullet, I would call it a decade-long slump. Industry-wide slump in good mainstream role-playing games. Obviously, there's always cool indie stuff.
Yeah, obviously.
But they, not only do those not reach huge audiences,
like,
but...
Well, yeah, I mean, think about it, right? So, like, the things that we've talked about today, right? Mass Effect, and we're not including Andromeda because that's a whole
That's part of the slump. That's
a slump.
Just talk about.
Right. But Mass Effect 3, what was that, 2011 or 12 or something like 11, that?
Yeah. Maybe 13 at the latest, but I think even before that.
But, you know, Witcher 3, was that after Mass Effect 3?
Yes.
But, like, very barely, time frame.
Let's talk about it like this. So, you know, Mass Effect series ends.
Mm-hmm.
New Vegas was a 2010 or 2009?
2010.
Yeah. Then we have a pretty severe slump in, you know, role-playing games of that quality with that amount of choice and, like, impactful player-driven decision-making. And some bad sequels come out of that, like Fallout 4. Not a bad video game, but a bad role-playing experience with a dumb story.
Mm-hmm.
Mass Effect Andromeda. Made the right decision to, not continue Shepard's story after it was concluded in a variety of different ways, so you couldn't really continue that story, because which one do you go with?
Mm-hmm.
Which ending do you go with? I would call The Witcher 3 the kind of, like, lone standout during this decade.
Of, like, you know... And, like, I guess, I don't know, is Witcher 3 even AAA and, like, you know, mainstream?
It definitely achieved mainstream success, but at that time was CDPR... I mean, it's AAA quality. Like, it's a fucking good video game, and it had a lot of money because the Polish government funded a bunch of art programs. Because
I would definitely call Cyberpunk 77... AAA.
Yeah.
Right? But, like, was Witcher more of an indie thing at the time?
At the time, I think you really could argue that it was more of an indie project, and that they were, you know, they were making the Witcher games instead of, I don't know, anything else, because when they bought the rights to the Witcher from a Polish author for not very much money, because they didn't have very much money.
Anyways, the point we're making is all the, like, supposedly, oh, this is going to be, like, the next big role-playing game, never was.
Yeah.
In, like, the, you know, the 2010s up until, you know, Cyberpunk is where we have, you know, the Renaissance begins.
Yeah, I think, like, some good stuff, but other stuff, like Disco Elysium is meant to be amazing. I didn't play it, but indie as hell.
Mm-hmm.
And
but every big thing they said never was good.
Everything they said was going to be like the next whatever, like Anthem.
The next Skyrim.
Anthem, what a huge Anthem. Fucking flop that
Destiny.
Was.
Destiny.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people still like Destiny, but they like it as
a... Not a role-playing game. They like it as an online role-playing game.
Right, as an action shooter.
Action. Online action.
It's a looter shooter.
Looter.
And it is a good looter shooter if that's what you enjoy, but as far as a role-playing game, like your character creation means jack shit, and you don't get to make any choices in that game. Mm-hmm. It's just a shooter.
Yes.
But then, so a decade-long slump where, like, mainstream video games were doing a pretty bad job of delivering what we would call, you know...
A role-playing experience.
A deep and satisfying role-playing experience where your choices mattered and there were options.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of coming back now. It's Baldur's Gate 3 came out last year. And I haven't finished it. I got distracted. But it's pretty great as far as, like, I don't always love what's going on, but it's insane the amount of choice that you have and the way the game is designed to absorb your input and kick you back something unique based on the decisions you've made. So it's coming back. Really cool. And the reason it's on this list is because that's what makes pen and paper gaming fucking cool. You know, if you have an engaged party and a good game master,
your character has bearing on the game.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't always pay off, but, like, you still get to think it might.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, like, robust character creation is, like, the bit on the outline here.
Yeah.
But it goes along exactly with what we were saying, right? Video games have been like, okay, character creation is very important. And all those fucking, like, poser RPG video games are like, yeah, character creation. You get to choose how your character looks and whatever. I mean, it's still kind of cool. Everybody gets off on that.
It's on this list because it's a cool thing from pen and paper games that video games have
taken
and basically made obligatory in most games.
What really made pen and paper role-playing games cool? It's like, yes, it's cool to choose how you appear, right? But it also is cool to have impact on the game.
Right. And, you know, like we just said, Destiny having a character creation screen does not make it a great video game. Or, sorry, doesn't make it a great role-playing game just because you get to choose...
color eyes you have.
Right. Or your fucking hairstyle or, you know, like your species. Things that are staples of the pen and paper gaming experience. Just because they're in a video game doesn't mean they hit with any fucking impact.
But
it is a good thing from TTRPGs that most video games are doing now.
And it doesn't have to have, like, a wide-reaching, world-changing impact. But, like... statting your character out to be, like, more of a talky-talky than a shooty-shooty.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, coming to a situation where I don't see how this doesn't end in a fight, but then getting that speech option and, like, hitting it and being like, I guess we're not fighting because...
Oh, another great
charisma,
one.
Bitch.
Should have gone on this list. Was Outer Worlds. I don't know how many people played that one. And maybe it's an indie... Not really. I mean, it's a AAA publisher, and Obsidian is the team that wrote New Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
But that was basically a Fallout game in space in a way that Starfield sure as fuck is not. Starfield is a huge, like, Starfield feels like it came out 10 years ago for its fucking quality and what a whiff it is, in my opinion. But Outer Worlds was great. Fallout in space, great formula. You have a spaceship. You take it to different planets. You do quests. You talk to people. And things like your perks and your stats have impactful bearing on gameplay because suddenly, because of a stat you had or a little like perk about your background that you picked way back in character creation, like, oh, I know something about this. I can do a part of the quest in a way that nobody else can because I know how to just, like, I can click on the thing and fix it. My character knows how to do that. Otherwise, the quest goes in a completely different direction. That the you know, robust character creation, it's not enough to just have it.
Right. It's got to have some impact, some and some noticeable impact, right? Like, it doesn't help if it's all behind the screen, right? Like, you have to have a choice that you can make that you wouldn't be able to make otherwise.
Yeah.
Right? Speaking of choices and whatever, that was a weak segue.
Mm.
I'm sorry. But let's talk about Spreading Democracy.
Okay, yeah. Helldivers 2.
I meant it to be more, because, like, people are mad that one of the criticisms about what we're about to talk about is,
oh, well, it doesn't fucking matter. Mm. Like, what we do doesn't matter. Joel's just going to do whatever he wants to do.
That's what I was trying to get at.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the thing, and then maybe you can do the joke.
Do the joke again.
Just again.
Get a redo.
Yeah, okay. A little bit later. So, Helldivers 2 blew up for good reason. It's fucking high quality. High quality, really fun gameplay loop. And a lot of people...
Well, also, let's just... Helldivers 2. Why are we talking about Helldivers 2 in a role-playing conversation where we just spent, like, 15 minutes talking about robust character creation?
Mm. And I also said that we weren't really talking about multiplayer shooters stuff, but...
But here we are talking about Helldivers 2.
Here we are.
So, Helldivers 2 might not have robust character creation, but it has some fantastic role-playing, tabletop role-playing elements.
Yeah. That you wouldn't maybe have expected. I read some stuff about it before the game came out. I was following it pretty closely, and they were talking about, like, oh, we're going to have, like, devs who are game masters actually with their, like, fingers in the soup while you're playing. And I was like, well, that's very interesting. How is that going to work? And then when it came out, we started to see how it works. Really fucking cool. The evolving galactic war map that is played, like, there are devs. There's Joel in the... There's a dev named Joel, maybe or maybe not. Even if there is a dev named Joel, I'm sure there's a team who actually does this. There's probably a team of game master devs.
This didn't dawn on me while we were writing the outline and talking about it, but, like, Joel is, like, a Twitch meme now.
Is it?
And, like, not... It predates Helldivers 2, so I'm curious if Helldivers 2 named the game master Joel. Yeah,
because, like, I mean, obviously, if you're a fucking game developer and you have something like this going on, you're not going to throw a real person to the wolves.
Here's their address.
Yeah. You're not going to throw a real member of your team with their name. You're not going to dox them to the community and to all of Reddit and Twitter. It's probably not a real... It might be a real guy, but that's probably not his name, and I think it's probably a team.
Yeah.
But...
So what do they do? What does Joel do?
Okay. Huh? So, evolving galactic war map, there's... there's various sectors of the galaxy, each with a number of planets, and each planet has a bar of how liberated it is, and
democracy.
That bar is impacted by mission success and mission failure, and they
aggregate the community's success.
Community success adds up to, like, you know, you push. You have lots of people playing in all the servers, fighting on one planet and pushing the bugs back until the planet is liberated, whatever. So they establish that basic framework for how the Galactic War is going to work, and then they have game masters who present events and, you know, major orders to the army, which is all of you playing. You're like, major order, liberate these bug planets. Major order, you know, defend Malevolon Creek. And suddenly, you know, you were just playing a drop-in, drop-out extraction shooter. Suddenly you're doing that, and it kicks ass, but you're also role-playing. Because the campaign is now a live thing that reacts to your input.
Right. And you get on, like, the Reddits, and they're like, we gotta defend Malevolon Creek! Everybody go, go, go!
Yeah.
And it becomes this...
I know we're weeks late on the Malevolon Creek stuff, but, like, that was what was cool.
And it was hot. I don't actually get to play Helldivers because my computer kind of sucks and I don't have a PlayStation. So I wasn't, like, involved in it, but the algorithms of my social media still fed me a bunch of that stuff.
Before I was playing, my Instagram For You page was, like, fucking Helldivers. And sometimes it was just, like, funny clips of cool stuff that happened on great missions, but a lot of times it was, like, people are role-playing so hard without even, you know...
knowing that
without even trying. Suddenly they're like, oh, well, yeah, for democracy, and you do your stupid little salute in-game when you launch the missile. Like, you shouldn't be doing that if you, you know... if it was, like... if it was a competitive, you know, player-versus player shooter.
Right, like, it's not optimal. Like, you could get, like, totally murked when you're, you know, trying to hot dog.
But people didn't care. They were fucking... they were role-playing.
Yes. Right? There was a bit of backlash on the, like, peek behind the screen about, like, oh, how it actually works. And, like, Joel, the game master, has, like, you know, he gets, like, to choose events and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then, like, a lot of people were getting mad.
Some specific stuff happened where, like, oh, like, suddenly, oh, we lost Malevolent Creek a bunch of times and we took it back, whatever. People would, you know, sign in the morning and realize that, like, oh, as the... you know, as the Earth spun around the sun and people went to sleep, the bugs or the robots, they continued to fight in the galactic map. Their ticker continued to go up. And because people weren't playing, because they were asleep, like, oh, my progress is lost. Or you start to win a planet too quickly. Joel, finger quotes.
Yeah.
You know,
the game master's like...
He gives them a buff.
It's going to be harder now.
He buffs the you know, he buffs the bot missions just like mid thing, and there was a lot of talk. I don't think it was the majority of players. I think most people were still just having fun, having a good time, but the loud sweats were like, well, you know, this is like, how is this fair? If there's a game master who just can do this, why am I trying so hard? Why, like, what value does my victory or failure have if the game master can just choose outcomes by tweaking numbers? And, you know, this is something that everyone who's ever run a pen and paper game knows, is like, sometimes, you know, you boof it. And behind the screen, you gotta be like, this needs to be a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And without telling anybody...
you make those corrections.
You make those corrections. You're like, oh, that damage would have killed him. We're just going to keep this fight going until I feel like it dramatically concludes.
So that's something that, like, pen and paper role players are kind of used to, right? But something that video gamers aren't necessarily, right? So when we were talking in the beginning, all those minutes ago, about the Venn diagrams and they're kind of converging, right? So, like, those move closer. The player bases don't necessarily.
Right.
So, like, they're, like, left out of the
circle.
Or
not as quick.
They're left out of the circle for a little bit. They got to get back on board, right? So there's going to be some growing pains.
Yeah.
Right? Perfect segue. Nailed it.
Perfect. Fucking, yeah.
So Helldivers 2 is a perfect example of this.
Yeah. So, you know, people develop metas. They deeply analyze, you know, like
optimal play,
the optimal gear loadout, and you know what is best for what mission. Oh, this particular type of enemy. Well, we need to have someone on our team who has this stratagem or carrying this weapon, and you know, booting players out of your party if they have
the wrong gear, like the wrong weapon equipped. Yeah. It's like, oh, get this noob out of here.
And I mean, you know, it kind of sucks.
It does kind of suck. People should be nicer to each other.
Yeah. But kicking casuals, people who are treating it like a competitive shooter, almost like a competitive PvP shooter, even though there's no PvP, there's friendly fire, but that's there to be funny.
Yeah.
You know, you don't gain anything by hurting each other. You fail missions. You know, you lose out on success when you don't work together, but also, you know, there was never any real impetus, like, oh, we gotta nail it,
right? Well, and so it just, it's an interesting like intersection of play styles, right? Because you have the sweat lords who are optimizing their fun, which is a weird thing, and we're not going to get into that.
Yeah. But it's a thing that people do.
They do. And then you have, like, the casual video game players who are really into, like, the role play, like, the fantasy of, like, you know, the galactic...
I'm a space soldier, and this...
New Republic,
you know, this Starship Troopers vibe is fucking fun to play as. And, you know, and just, it's fun to, like, move your character and shoot the bugs and use the guns and stuff. So, you know, you're just having fun. And... You know, I would say maybe a subset of that, the ones who maybe understand a little bit more about the pen and paper side and recognize that, you know, because a game master on the Arrowhead team changes a planet so that suddenly missions are harder or...
Right. The meta's changed now, right?
Now the meta has changed and this loadout isn't just wiping missions the way it used to. With it, that is not in the service necessarily of... perfect balance, but it's in the service of fun and drama
and like opportunity. Yeah, right. You know, it's something like, oh, I get to play with different weapons now.
Yeah, it's meant to push you into that. When they, you know, when they're like, oh, suddenly this mission's super hard because just a game master turned his Eye of Sauron on, happened to turn his Eye of Sauron on your mission and was like, these guys. You're getting mega bot drops. I don't know. And you're like, oh, this is so fucking unfair. Where is this coming from? This is not in line with, you know, the mission I thought I was doing, whatever. It's just meant to be exciting. It's meant to be exciting and dramatic. And it's way more important, I think, and I think this is the philosophy I'm kind of putting words in their mouth, of the Arrowhead devs. We're like, a fun... dramatic mission where maybe you fail has more value than optimizing your loadouts
and winning easily,
wiping the mission, getting a perfect score, and then dropping to just do it again immediately. And that's not a bad thing if that's what you enjoy,
right? Different folks,
but that's the experience that they are trying to deliver, I think, by having live game masters influence the Galactic War and specific missions and battlefields in real time. I think they're just trying to make it, you know, dramatic and funny and exciting, which doesn't always mean fair, doesn't always mean you win.
Right? And then, like, you know, if you don't like it, don't play it, right? You know, it's supposed to be fun. If it's fun for somebody, doesn't mean it's wrong, right? You know, when your hobby starts to change around you, like, oh, I really enjoyed Helldivers because I, like, optimized the hell out of it, and I have my, like, loadout, I did the grind, I have, you know, all this good gear. Oh, they totally changed the rules on me. I shouldn't have done a voice there. I was trying to be serious. Oh, they changed the rules on me. Yeah, man, that does suck. But, like, they're not trying to be an asshole, so you shouldn't either. Like, nobody's the asshole here.
Yeah.
Right?
And balancing, especially a combat experience in TTRPG, Matt Colville in his How to Be a DM videos, he has a thing that he said a couple of times where every combat encounter that he puts in front of his players is almost always an untested prototype. And that means that in the service of drama and balance, both, you might have to just tweak it on the fly. And... that's kind of a new thing for competitive video game play.
Yeah.
Which is why it's in this growing pains section.
Yeah. And, like, you know, it goes the other way too, right? You got the hardcore old school heads in the tabletop role-playing space who are like, oh, four stats? That's not enough. Like, this game is trash.
Right. Where's the specialization?
Where's my special pickpocket thing? Because there's going to come one moment where I get to do one roll and I have this bonus.
And I want every single thing I ever did in character creation to pay off in a dramatic moment. And sometimes it just doesn't.
Yeah. But, I mean, there it is. So, we talked about a lot of things, eh?
Yeah, we did. A lot of cool things. Let's just run through this real quick recap. Okay, so we talked about the converging Venn diagram of pen and paper play and video game play. Converging, meaning they're starting to become more and more like each other.
Right, they're taking lessons from each other and teaching each other lessons.
Yeah. We talked about what tabletop RPGs have learned from video games. We had a big list: remote play, virtual tabletops, streamlined rule sets, everything in service of reducing the load on the human computer that runs the game. And we also talked a little bit about solo RPGs. Maybe some point in the future we'll talk more about that. We don't know a ton about it yet, but it exists and it's cool.
We also talked about video games, what they learned from the tabletop role-playing games, right? Focusing on impactful player choice, branching narratives, character creation, having an impact, right? Not just like, oh, I have blue eyes and, you know, red hair and a mohawk.
Oh, I'm like the robot species, okay.
I took this background that is going to come up later.
Yeah.
Right? Then we talked a lot about Helldivers 2, right? An evolving galactic war map that changes and has game masters.
Yeah, live game masters. With stuff. Now, it said here, not the first time this has been tried, but at the first like mainstream success. I can't think of any other times where this has been a thing. I can't remember which one of us wrote that bullet point. And
I'd imagine
if I wrote it.
But
I don't know what I was talking
well,
about.
Well, like, I remember there were some, like, I think it was a show that also had a video game, and, like, the choices that people playing the video game would
that
influence
might
the
have
show.
Been it. I remember Do us remember having that? This conversation, okay. I think, but I can't remember the title or the property.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah, so there's been things like this, but this is the first time I can remember engaging with anything like the Galactic War map in Helldivers, where a team on the studio was running it like Game Masters.
I think also For Honor had a system like that, but like it never actually had an impact.
Okay, actually, I'm thinking of a couple
and also
of things. Maybe.
For Honor flopped big time.
It did. There was a Warhammer Fantasy RPG, an MMO. It was meant to be like Warhammer World of Warcraft, and that had a system where based on player engagement, you would there was like three big war zones between the big factions, and then they were broken up into like subzones and then subzones inside those subzones, and as you achieved victories it would like push control in either direction. I can't remember anything about how that game actually played out. I was old enough to be interested in it. I never had a PC that could run it. So
classic.
I also know that that game died and the servers got shut down. No. So
I'm sure stuff like this has been tried before, tested,
but suddenly Helldivers bashes onto the screen with like a 200 person team. I think even smaller than that. And shows us how great things could be.
Yeah.
Anyway, then we talked about growing pains.
There's going to be some growing pains. As things change, there's going to be some pain associated with that because, you know, change is change.
Change. Audiences on either side. You know, like, well, why is this video game thing in my TTRPG?
Mm-hmm.
We talked about how video game people are having a hard time really grokking what live game mastering means for Helldivers and what they consider to be a competitive sport, essentially. But it's all for fun.
All for fun.
Anywho's, I think that about do it for this episode of Two-Headed Game Master. If you like what you heard or you like role-playing stuff in general, head on over to 2hgm.com. We've got some stuff there.
Yeah, first thing you're going to see is, isn't an ad, whatever. It's a pop-up that says, hey, we released a whole RP.
It's an ad. It's an old-school pop-up advertisement.
Old-school pop-up.
But instead of for your penis, it's for a role-playing game.
We got a whole role-playing game setting and rule system that we made up available on drivethroughrpg.com. A print and a digital PDF are available. If you buy the print, you get the digital PDF included.
Mm-hmm.
So buy the print, get the PDF, share it with your players, and you get a cool rule book with some art and whatevers.
Yeah.
Also, link to our Patreon. We have a Patreon. Support us if you like our stuff.
We love the support. We're getting more active on Discord, and we're trying to do more like
more live events,
hangouts, yep. and play things. We just did the Quarry.
Whole live ass stream.
That the entire stream is available on
for our patrons.
For our patrons, just as a big 8-hour video you can watch. Really cool. I had a great time. And we're going to be making a little bit more content generated from that. But we would like to do more stuff like that, and that becomes easier the more people are involved.
Mm.
Also more fun, you know, because we...
Because chat.
Well, because we time-outed our only chatters for being... Well, not for being anything, just because it was funny. But then we played all night, and not everyone stuck around.
Yeah.
So we need more patrons in more time zones.
Truth. So just join us next time for another episode of Two-Headed Game Master.
Thank you to the Burning Saviors for the use of the song Pond Hillow's Finest as the intro and outro to our show. We'll see y'all next time.
See you next time.